Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download and 30-day free trial at www.audibletrial.com/verbalshenanigans. Over 150,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player.
But our shenanigans are cheeky and fun.
Yeah, I mean, his shenanigans are cruel and tragic.
Which makes them not shenanigans at all, really.
Evil shenanigans.
I swear to God, I'll pistol whip the next guy that says shenanigans.
And we are back again. We are back again. No, we're not back yet because that audio is way too high.
Way too high.
Now we should be back again.
Oh, yeah, we're back. We're back.
All right, well, we'll see if that little singing makes it into it, because the audio was a little hot and I was adjusting it on the fly, but...
There goes my singing career.
Welcome back to the Verbal Shenanigans podcast. We are very happy to be back. Michael Berlew, as always, Welcome aboard again. Not aboard. It should be like welcome back, I guess.
Welcome ashore.
Yes.
Any other nautical terms we can think of?
I don't know.
SS Minnow?
I don't know, but we are back, and this is episode 60-something or other, and we just came off a great podcast where we were at Pocono Raceway.
It was a great day. It was a great experience, a lot of nice people to meet, and unfortunately, there was a sad tragedy the next day. It was a very entertaining race for the most part, and unfortunately... As a lot of people do know, one of the drivers, Justin Wilson, lost his life in one of the accidents that occurred on Sunday.
Yeah, pretty terrible. I was in and out that day. I wanted to try to watch the race. I watched a little bit. You know, racing's not my thing, so I kind of put it on. And I was actually more checking the three people that we interviewed, Sato, Mann, and Karam, and how they were doing. And then I went out for a little while, and I was getting updates and stuff like that. And I came back and went to my brother's house, and I was looking, and they showed a clip of the accident and whatnot. And pretty crazy. It's a piece of Sage Karam's car. The nose of it, and it ended up hitting another driver, and he ended up losing his life. Very sad.
Yeah, it was a freak accident. It was nothing that Sage did. It was nothing... at the Pocono Raceway that was faulty or anything like that. It was just nothing way of saying but a one in a million shot, and sadly we lost a good person because of that. I will say out there the only good thing that could come from this, I got word he was an organ donor, so six of his organs went out to various people, and he saved six lives. So if you have to go, it's nice to know he went out kind of like a hero. He saved a lot of people's lives there. We wish Justin was around. We send our prayers to their family. But I guess in the end, some good people get to live on a little bit more thanks to Justin.
Yeah. It's a sad story. Unfortunately, it's kind of part of the territory of racing. You know, it's a highly dangerous sport. 220 miles an hour, you're one... there's so many variables. You know, you're one slip of the hand, you're relying on machinery, you know, there's things in your control, and then there's a ton of things that are out of your control, too. And, you know, you kind of take it for granted watching it on TV or even watching it live, how freaking fast they're going, too. You know, like hitting anything at 200-something miles an hour, anything, like a screw or something like that, you know, can kill you. Never mind a piece of a car, you know, piece of a car.
Like yeah, it's just such a sad, freaky thing, and it goes to show you, man, every time they go out there, they're badasses. They know that they're putting their lives on the line, and it's such a shame that what occurred, especially that it was such a good race. Sage was having a good race. He just slipped there on that accident. Sato, he ended up with a sixth place. He was up there in the top three
for right
a
to
while.
The end, too.
Yeah.
Right to the end. I was a little upset at the ending. You know, the on a yellow flag, I guess.
Yeah, they don't have NASCAR rules. NASCAR rules is they're going to give, if there's a caution that comes where they're going to hit the length of the race, they're going to have three attempts at a green-white checker. So three times they'll throw the green flag. If they make it to the white flag, the next flag ends the race, whether it's a caution flag or the checkered flag. If there's a caution before they hit that white flag, they're going to try it one second time, they'll try it a third time, and then they'll call the race after that.
Yeah. It just felt like very anticlimactic because like, I tuned in for those last, I don't know, I think it said like 11 to go or something like that. And I was like, oh, this is kind of entertaining. My guys are up front, you know, like, you know, Sato's there, my man Sato.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was just like, I was like, what? It's over? Like, what?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, huh?
That, NASCAR used to be like that, and too many people got mad. Well, what first happened was NASCAR used to race under a caution. So if a yellow flag comes out, everybody kept on going their exact speed until somebody hits the finish line to initiate a caution. And then what happened was there was just a lot of danger because a crash would happen right in front of the start-finish line. And you see these people going like 180 right past a car that can't move anywhere. And the driver's like, oh, what the hell? And
yeah.
So they instituted that kind of rule where it's like, well, if it ends under caution, it ends under caution, and then people got mad, so green-white checker.
Yeah, well, you know, like I said, it is a tragedy, but overall, on our end, it was a hell of an experience, a second experience working with the Pocono guys and then Kevin and his staff over there could not have treated us any damn better. And hopefully we're establishing a working relationship, and who knows where that's going to take us. And you know, we are getting some cracking. I don't know what that is. It's gone. I think. Maybe.
What are you doing, Crackle?
I think it's one of these mic cables. I can't figure out which one it is, but I try. Well, that's okay. So anyway, it is good to be back. Michael Berlow, I got some news today.
Ooh.
I got some news today.
Good or bad?
It is good. Let me just bring it up. I didn't even tell you yet. I'm transitioning.
Okay.
No, that's not the news. But, come on, email work. Maybe the phone will. Okay.
You've been pre-approved for a Visa card? Oh, my God. Congratulations.
Let me read it, and then we'll talk about it for a second. And
all
then
right.
We actually have a great guest come on. All right. Verbal Shenanigans has a new sponsor.
Really?
New sponsor. You ever hear of DraftKings, Michael?
Of course.
Yes, DraftKings. You've heard them on all sorts of podcasts, on TV. They're blowing up all over the place. We are now an affiliate.
All right,
we
man.
Are. Fantasy sports fans are winning huge cash prizes every day at DraftKings.com, America's favorite place to play daily fantasy sports. Daily fantasy means no season-long commitment. Play whenever you want. Just pick your sport, draft your team. It's like a new season every time you play. So you're never stuck with the same players. Over $1 billion will be won at DraftKings.com this year, and you could be the next to win. So go to DraftKings.com now and enter the promo code Shenanigans to play. That's Shenanigans for free entry for a free entry now at DraftKings.com.
Okay, so they give away billions of dollars. So we got $1 billion worth of sponsorship?
We did. We got $1 billion. But anyway, I actually went to try to sign up for DraftKings.
DraftKings is a tad different.
DraftKings is a weird website.
I don't know about this sport.
But I went to sign up, and I said, you know what, let's try to become an affiliate. And I contacted the people, and it was a little surprise for the podcast today.
Ooh.
So I wanted to sign up anyway, so I figured it's a good opportunity to try to, hey, maybe if you sign up and give it a shot. It looks pretty fun. It's like a different fantasy game every day. You could do soccer, football, all sorts of stuff. I think you
do
racing,
golf.
Sports,
yeah, they do every single thing. And that's kind of interesting. You can change your team every day because, I mean, you seen with the old school ones, it's like, oh, I got some, like that Green Bay Packers wide receiver. He just tore his ACL.
Jordy Nelson.
Yeah, I mean, regular drafts, you're like, all right, I'm looking good. Oh, crap. Second week of the preseason, and my team is just effed.
So they claim people have won millions of dollars, hundreds of thousands of dollars just playing, and we're excited to have them on the cast as a partner. Right. So moving ahead, moving along, DraftKings.com.
Can we interview the Draft King?
The King? I don't know. He might still be around, but we'll get to that back to a little later. We have a guest coming on the show.
Mm-hmm.
We have been kind of playing, I guess you could call it Twitter tag. It's not really phone tag. I'm very excited about this guest.
I really am, too. I mean, when you told me Oliver North was going to join us tonight, that was just amazing.
No, he's not coming on.
No. You said something other. John Oliver from the Daily Show and last week tonight.
No.
The British guy. Oh, that's going to be so much fun tonight, man.
Not Oliver Twist either.
Cousin Oliver from the Brady Bunch. He was there for the final season. I can't believe you got him. I didn't know he's still alive.
No. A little bit better than that.
Ollie Hoppenoogles, that movie.
Anyway.
That was the third movie of the Christmas Story trilogy.
There was a trilogy?
Yes. Jesus I was Christ. Shocked when I found that out.
Well, we'll talk about that later because we want to try to get him on. But coming on the podcast is Greg Oliver. Now, Greg, that name might not mean anything to you, but Greg Oliver is known for some of his documentary work. Now, I heard of his name because I'm a big fan of Tell 'Em Steve Dave and What Say You podcast, both which have Brian Quinn from Impractical Jokers. Now, he is kind of getting behind this project on a movie called Turn Towards the Sun, which was a fascinating movie. We'll get into that when we get Greg on. But he also directed Lemmy, which was an awesome documentary about, Lemmy from Motorhead. So we're going to try to get him on the line right now. And it's been more than probably a couple months of trying to track him down. So hopefully Mr. Greg Oliver will be getting on the line here.
Yeah, he might be a wrecker. I mean, I know Leon Rainbow. It took about a couple months to get him on the show.
Yep.
But I guess the ultimate record is when Sean Kemp finally calls in.
Yes. So let's see if Mr. Oliver answers, and if not, we'll pause it.
I don't hear the do song.
Come on, Greggy. Connecting. Still connected.
Boom.
But that's pretty much happened every time we've got someone. So I'm hoping that he. Comes
we've had
right
some
back.
Good podcasts from the screws up of Skype.
But yes, a little bit more about Greg Oliver, in this film. From what I understand, Brian Quinn has no money invested in it. He just simply is very interested about getting this man, Mickey Byrne's story told. And after we go over this, hopefully you will understand kind of some of the things this miraculous man, just one of the most interesting men I can think of or hearing story about.
I mean, I would describe him as a real-life Forrest Gump. If you remember the Forrest Gump movie, like he would just do a random thing, and all of a sudden he's like in the president's office, and he's... You know, he's involved with, like, crazy stuff, like ping pong. And this is exactly how I look at Mickey Byrne. It's just so many weird things, just connect things. It's like, oh, my God, he has this and that. And he's so humble. It's like he drops a name. We'll wait for the interview. But he's like, oh, I don't want to really do it. It's like, dude, that's an amazing story.
I know. Yeah, it is pretty amazing. It's funny because I compared you to a modern-day Forrest Gump the other day.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Now we got two Forrest Gumps on...
Yeah. We're legends, man. I mean, well, they never made a sequel. No. They did make a book sequel, but they never
did. Forrest Gump 2?
Yep.
Like Post Gump?
I forget the name of it. I'll look it up, but there was a book made of it.
Well, we're going to try to get Greg on again. If we have to, we'll go to a break.
So, Scott, DraftKings.com?
DraftKings.com. New affiliate.
Hello, you've reached the office of Greg Oliver.
Yellow.
Hey, Greg, it's Scott Brennan and Michael Berlew from Verbal Shenanigans Podcast. How's it going?
Good, guys. So, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, you're a little echoey. Are you in like a big room or something?
I am in a big room. I don't have a smaller room.
Well, shrink that room down, man.
I'm so famous, I can't purchase small rooms anymore. It's impossible.
I'm so not famous that I can't afford furniture to absorb sound.
You sound like you're in a cathedral, kind of.
Really? Let me see if I just, maybe it's because these headphones I have on. Is that any better?
No. Are you talking through a mic or are you just talking?
Talking like in a headset, earphones.
Oh, okay.
Do you have your audio settings on Skype set to the computer mic or the mic that you're wearing?
Let me find out.
That's probably what's going on.
It's in preferences?
If you go to tools.
Yeah.
And you go to options. And you go to audio settings. Yeah. You should see a thing that says microphone. Now, it's probably bouncing when you talk. But you have the option of line in. You got microphone. You might have like something that says a USB microphone, whatever you're using there.
I don't have a microphone, built-in microphone. Is it internal microphone? That's the computer one, right?
Yes.
Should I call my friends in India, Scott?
Yeah, get your IT guys on the line.
What's that? It says display. What the fuck does this mean? Same as system. Does it sound any better or same?
You still sound echoey, but it's all right.
Mm-hmm. I'm gonna get this right. I dragged this out for so fucking long. I gotta at least sound good. It's not giving me the hang on a second. General notifications, advanced.
More importantly, how do we sound?
Mm-hmm. You guys sound great. It makes me feel stupid.
Good.
Yeah. Because I don't sound
well.
Good.
Once you listen to me talk, you won't feel that way anymore.
Yeah. You'll feel very smart.
Yeah, you guys sound good. Hey, I'm just trying to figure out. It's not giving me an option. Microphone, same. It's only giving me same as system, display audio, or built-in microphone.
Suddenly changed.
Does that sound any better?
Well, now we hear an Indy car for some reason.
Whoa.
Yeah, I'm also next to a racetrack. Is that sound any better, or is it worse, or the same?
If you could bring the volume up a little bit, you might be better. It took out the echo.
How's that? Hello, hello. Check it. Check it. 1, 2. Check it.
It's okay.
Shit. Should I do this on the phone? Is that better? Would you rather do it on the phone?
No. Skype is, it's kind of a whole different hookup. But you sound okay. I can make you sound better here.
I don't know what the. Is that like? Are you hearing that banging?
Oh yeah, it sounds like you're punching us in the face.
So it's still using the microphone on the computer, not the one on my headset.
It's definitely using the computer microphone. I could tell just by the amount of noise in the room.
Okay, so let me figure it out. But I don't have the fucking option. Microphone, built-in microphone, and the same as system.
What is your headset? Is it USB?
No, it's just like a cell phone one. So it probably does not even understand that it's a headset.
Oh. That might have been also why it still kind of sounded crazy, because it's just a little cell phone one. But let's make it work. Let's make it work.
Let's just start playing fucking music. Sorry.
Yeah. Play some Motorhead.
Oh no, that won't work. Should I just talk closer to the laptop? I don't ever use Skype.
Wow.
That's a nice little beat that was going there for a minute.
It sounded like you were like throwing many things towards the computer. But just go ahead and talk real quick. We could always chop this all up.
How do I sound now? Do I sound any better?
Oh, that's
way better.
That's way
better. So now I'm just leaning and drooling over my laptop, so that'll work.
Excellent. So like as the interview goes on, it'll get like more like watery and like...
Yeah, if you hear dripping, my jowls.
All right. I mean, I'm definitely not cutting any of that out. That was awesome.
No.
Don't cut it out. That was the best part. That's as good as it's going to get.
That's fine. Greg, Oliver, I was just before you came on, I was saying we've been playing Twitter tag, not even phone tag. We've been playing Twitter tag for about, 2 months, something like that.
Yeah, and it's all my fault, man. I'm sorry. I'm like shy for interviews, and I just like to push it as long as I can until you get totally fucking irritated, and then just bail on me, and then I'm like, oh, that's their fault.
So basically that was the nice way of saying that I hounded you until you just said yes.
No, I'm glad you did.
But anyway, Greg, how I got the idea of reaching out to you, I was saying that I'm a big fan of Tell 'Em Steve Dave and What Say You, and they mentioned your film, Turn Towards the Sun, that's coming out, and you know, it sounded like an interesting story, so I wanted to reach out to you. But it, even before that, it turns out that you directed one of my favorite documentaries, which I've watched on Fuse late at night several times. You directed Lemmy.
Yeah, man.
What the hell is that like? That has to be like the greatest thing to work on.
Yeah, and looking back, everything's awesome. It's just like this magical moment in life. But when you're in the middle of 3 years of dealing with somebody named Lemmy Kilmister, it's not always fun games, man.
I don't know. He seems like a laid-back kind of guy, you know. He gets up around like 11 o'clock, has a sip of tea.
More like, yeah, and then he calls me on my phone. He's like, hey, Greg, why don't you come on over? We'll do some filming today. Come on in.
That's totally Lemmy right there.
Yeah, no, it was an awesome experience and a really great film to have been part of, but it was a really hard one to make just because of the nature of the beast. And also, and it was like any documentary, it was hard to find money, even though it was Lemmy and Motorhead, it was hard to finance it. So it was just like a tough one to make, where it literally took like, I think it was 4 years by the time we started it to the time it actually came out.
Jeez. Now, how did you get hooked up on that? Like, now I know you have some other films. Those are the two I know I've seen. Well, the one we're going to talk about in a minute, and Lemmy. But have you been doing film for a long time? Or
yeah, man, I went to film school in New York. Like 20 years ago. I've been in New York for like 22 years or something, and always did like music videos, and I just love music. Grew up just blasting music my whole life. My dad would wake us up blasting music in the house. So I'm just always, you know, huge fan of all sorts of music. And then I was doing like music videos in college, because just so I could be closer to bands and rolling cameras on bands. And then
what college you go to?
The School of Visual Arts.
Oh, nice. My my buddy Taryn graduated from there, and he works now in like, I don't know, all sorts of graphic animation and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But
yeah, they have like really good graphic arts program. I think all the filmmakers are still broke, so I wouldn't necessarily recommend that as a film school. Yeah.
I feel like that's how it goes. But yeah. So anyway, so you you were making music videos, and then what?
Yeah, so then I'm hanging out with Burning Spear, the old reggae artist. Uh-huh. And so he was like, I want you to tell. I did some music videos for him, and he's like, I want you to tell I-Man's story. I'm like, what does that mean? He's like, I want you to tell my story. I'm like, okay, but what does that mean? He's like, I want you to make a documentary about me. I was like, okay, I've never made one before. He's like, it's okay. You know I-Man. I-Man will tell you a story on camera. I'm like, okay. So I made my first documentary with Burning Spear. And it ended up falling apart. But while we were shooting it, which was really fun, I met this dude that was a journalist who knew Lemmy. And he was helping me with Burning Spear stuff. And then he's like, hey, man, you want to make a film on Lemmy? I can get to him. I'm like, yeah, sure, if you can get to him. And I was only like a casual fan at that point. I knew Ace of Spades and stuff, but the man Lemmy sounded intriguing. And so that journalist sent Lemmy's management my work that I had done, and it literally just so happened to be that one of his managers loved Burning Spear. So it was kind of like this weird kismet thing where he's like, this is awesome, I love Burning Spear. He's like, I'm going to talk to Lemmy, and I'll see if I can get you guys a meeting with him. And the next thing you know, we're at the Rainbow drinking with Lemmy, trying to sell ourselves.
Now, like Lemmy, from what everything you see and hear, is pretty much that guy that's on your film. Is that accurate? Like, is he just like that guy who's into his own thing, living in that small apartment, you know, going to the Rainbow every couple of days or whatever it is, gambling? Is that literally how he is?
Oh, dude, it's not a show, man. It's 100% real. It's crazy. It's just that's him and that's all he does. And we filmed that's like 100,000% real, that film. It's like there's nothing exaggerated in it, man. It's just like that's what he does. He's wherever he is right this second, he's just sitting backstage with a bunch of scrappy chicks hanging around. Or no chicks at all, or he's at home playing video games on his really nasty couch.
Great.
Yeah, no, that's all. It's 100% real, and that's like it's one of the guys that doesn't put on a persona. I'm sure he's got a soft side in him somewhere, but he certainly didn't come out in the film. A little bit. There's a little tender moment with his son.
Yeah.
But he's like at home, he still wears his fucking tight ass jeans with like a bulge his pants.
You never know when a concert's gonna break out, man. Yeah. You gotta be ready. Got the bass by my side.
And if he's not wearing his tight ass jeans, he's wearing fucking Speedos that you don't need to see.
I like the jorts look, the really cut off shorts, like all the way up to his like questionable thigh. You know?
Yeah, he was mad that we put that in the film. He's like, "You stole that photo from my somewhere in my house and didn't tell me." I'm like, "No, I didn't." He's like, "Yes, you did. You stole that photo." I'm like, "Dude, look on the internet." He's like, He's like, "I don't like the internet." I'm like, "All right." If you looked on it and Googled you would find that picture.
If you Googled you.
The Google is not for Lemmy. Do you understand me?
No, he had a flip phone the whole time we were making that film, and it was awesome. Funny after the old 3 years of him just saying, "I'm not ever going to get a fucking smartphone. This phone's smart enough." And then like at the premiere of the film, he wouldn't pay any attention to me because he was on his iPhone playing.
He like sold out. With
friends or something. Yeah, it was funny.
Lemmy's into the Angry Birds.
Yeah. Oh no, he was. He loves fucking Angry Birds.
Let me ask: when you get thrown into this, do you go in there with like a baseline of what you think you're gonna do?
Was baseline a punch on Lemmy?
No.
Gotcha. Sorry.
I'm actually trying to be a journalist here for once, Scott.
But
do you go in there with like an outline, a baseline of what you plan to do, or is it just pretty much, all right, I'm going to meet this guy and I'm going to see where it goes from there?
No, you try your best to put your idea of what the film's going to be on paper. You know, we had like an outline and I had like scenes written after hanging out with him. We're like, I'm going to get him to do this and I'm going to get him to do that. And then you go film with him and he doesn't do any of those things. And then you get really mad because it's not working out. And then all of a sudden you could be filming with him. We'd film with him for like 3-4 days. And he's just like not doing anything that we'd planned to do. You know, like we'd fly to LA to film with him and he wouldn't do anything we fucking planned. And then all of a sudden this one little like moment would happen that was like nothing we would ever expect. And it would be sort of gold would happen. And that's when you realize you're making a documentary that you can't control and you're just like there for the ride and you got to be really patient and really like, I mean, I wanted to quit the film midway, like a year and a half into it, 2 years. I'm like, this is fucking stupid, man. This is going on for years and I don't see an end in sight. I don't see a story coming out. I just see a bunch of footage of this dude. And then we just stuck with it and kept going and going. And it just sort of shaped itself as we got, you know, 3 years into it. But, you can't really plan docs. I'm sure with some people you can. But he was not having anything that we tried to plan. He just like he'd just be like, yeah, no. The only time I got him excited about something and planned it was I found a tank for him to ride on. And I was like, Lemmy, I have a tank. He's like, you have a tank? I'm like, I have a German tank that you can fire that has full charge blanks that are full charge, which means the entire earth will shake. He's like, all right. He's like, I'll do that. He's like, he's like, is it close by? I'm like, it's not in Hollywood. He's like, where is it? I'm like, I just lied. I was like, it's right outside of Hollywood. He's like, okay. And he got a limo and a stripper friend of his to come. And then we got in the limo, their cameras. And then like, we're on like the, I don't know, 495 or whatever the hell is going south. And he's like, Greg, you lied to me. I'm like, I did, dude. I totally lied to you. But just shut up because there's a tank at the end of this drive. And then we got... If you've seen the film, if you saw the film on TV, you probably didn't see the tank scene because it was cut out of VH1, cut it out.
Well, it was on Fuse. I've seen it like I've definitely seen it twice, and it's been on where I just like leave it on in the middle of the night. Like it comes on at random times. So I feel like Lemmy in a Tank I may have seen.
Well, yeah, so that's like – but it's worth seeing if you like tanks and Motorhead. But he ended up – he was just – the only thing he said when he got to the tank was like – he's like, this is the smallest tank the Germans made, Greg. And I'm like – awesome. Just get in it.
Way to go, Greg.
Just drive around in it and fire it, and then you can go home, dude.
This guy is disappointed with a tank. How do you satisfy a man who's disappointed with a tank?
But then he smiled. He fired it and then smiled this big smile on his face. I'm like, yeah, there you go, motherfucker. It's a tank. He fired it.
So when you made that film, like how many hours of footage are you talking about here to compress it into, what was it, like an hour and a half or an hour?
Yeah, probably like 400 or 500 hours after 3 years of just shooting. There'd be like 2 cameras going. We'd shot a ton of concerts that were just kind of like worthless, but you just shoot them.
Right.
You're never going to use them, but you just roll camera anyway, or you just like always have a camera running. So there's easily 400 or 500 hours with 2 cameras. And then every interview we did with all these, there's so many people in the film. You'd interview him for like an hour, you know, so it was like 25-30 hours of interviews. It's crazy. It adds up really fast. It's daunting.
Yeah.
A huge mess to edit.
Yeah. See, the reason I asked you about, like, that, you know, like, hearing about the person that he is, because, like, even, like, the way, like, I don't know, someone like Dave Grohl talks about him, he always says, like, he's fucking Lemmy, man. He's just fucking Lemmy. That's it. You know, like, he's just that guy. He makes fun of musicians he doesn't like. He just seems like a straight shooter, like, 100%.
He is, man. He really is. He is what he sells. He's what everybody wants him to be. He is that guy. It's like that dude's like, probably, he said he doesn't, you know, he wants to, like, he's not going to die sitting at home on his couch or in a hospital. He wants to die on stage, and he's definitely fucking headed that way.
Damn. I mean, how many albums do they have at this point?
This is their Motorhead's 40th anniversary this year, and I think they have like 37 albums. I'm not sure, man. I don't know how many there are, but there's a lot. And he's, you know, he was in bands before that, Hawkwind and lots of other bands. So he's got a huge, huge amount of music that he's created. It's pretty crazy.
One day I just want them to be like the name Scott, and that they just think of like an image of me. Like, you hear the name Lemmy, you know, that's the only thing you think of is that guy. You know,
I got an image of Scott. I'm not sure if you want me to tell you about it. But.
I don't have an image yet, but don't like ruin it for me.
Well, he's a black man. He's got a huge afro. He's got a limp leg going here. I don't know what happened to him. It's very weird. He wears an eye patch for no good reason. He's got two good eyes. It's very odd how Scott rolls, but you know, that's Scott.
Right, the image is forming. Thank you.
Yes. Yeah.
And so, he has a tank too, by the way.
What size is his tank?
It's a Swiss tank. They're not known for their tank, so it's not as big as a German one. But, he gets by with it. He goes to school with it. So
that's good. I'm sure it works very well if it's Swiss.
Yeah.
So, Greg, let's get to the film, Turn Towards the Sun. So this is, I would say, someone completely different than Lemmy in a way, but in some ways similar. Just a guy named Mickey Byrne. I got in touch with you because I thought the film sounded really interesting, and sure enough, it was absolutely interesting. So before we begin, how did you get involved into a project like this? Like, he seems like a guy that had to be presented to you. Or that, like, an idea that was thrown at you that you had to be like, okay, I'm going to commit X amount of hours to learning this guy's life. Because this guy has, like, he's not a rock star or anything like that. He's, you know, he's got basically a century worth of interesting life.
Yeah, I mean, he's better than a rock star in my mind. It's funny how it happened. 100%. We were shooting Motorhead. We were on tour with Motorhead in Europe, in the UK. It was at an airport. With our film gear and a Motorhead shirt on, and this guy was waiting for a plane, and he came up to me. He's like, "You a filmmaker?" And I was like, "Yeah." He's like, "Oh man, I got a film you should make." I'm like, "Okay, what is it?" And he said, "I know this 97-year-old man that lives in the hills of Wales who's a poet, but he hung out with Hitler. His dad worked for the King of England. He was bisexual. His boyfriend was the spy Guy Bridges, and he was dating Audrey Hepburn's mother at the same time." He was shot and captured in this raid on Saint-Nazaire, France, and was a prisoner of war for 3 years in Colditz Castle and ran a secret radio room. He's like, "Do you want to meet him?" I'm like, "Yeah, right, dude.
Wait,
totally."
So you got approached as you were making Lemmy to make this film?
Yeah, I mean, by a random strange man.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah, no, it's like kind of like, you know, Lemmy sort of happened just randomly, and then this sort of happened by some strange guy in an airport telling me a story of a guy that he knew that needed a film made about him. And I was like, I didn't really believe anything he said. I was like, "Well, it sounds really interesting. If it's true, I'd love to be involved." And then like 6 weeks later, I got a DVD in the mail that had an interview with this little old man talking about these stories. And I was like, "Holy shit, man, he was not lying." And then I looked him up and did some research on him. And next thing you know, I'm like, "Well, all right, I'll direct the doc. Let's do it." So I went to Wales and hung out with Mickey, and it was like one of the coolest little old dudes I've ever met in my life. There'll never be anybody like that cool with that sort of that history that he was not only like witnessing, but like part of. It was incredible to hear this stuff. It was just kept going and going and going, where I was like, this is crazy. He was like, he'd be like, do you like jazz? I'm like, yeah, I don't like listen to it, but I know jazz. He's like, "You know Duke Ellington?" I'm like, "Sure." He's like, "I used to hang out with Duke in New York." Of course you did. Because you were screwing Audrey Hepburn's mother and dating spy guy just at the same time and hanging out with Hitler. He, like, hung out with Hitler.
I know. Like, that's on my list here. But, like, you think that's the life of, like, a documentary filmmaker, like, which makes the best documentaries, like to kind of just roll with the punches and find something instead of always having, like, an idea in the back of your head, just kind of, like, you're being present, you just got presented with something and just going, holy shit, okay, let's make this. Like, it is to me, like, to be presented with that and all the stars to align and stuff like that, it's got to be a weird moment to be told, like, to commit to that and commit. Like, how many years did this whole project take?
That was two. That was like 2 years of going back and forth to Wales from New York to spend time with him. But yeah, man, it's like it's like a dream come true. Like, I have like my list of ideas is like 100 things long that all 100 of them will never work.
Right.
And then something like that, like, you know, I could be like, I don't know, at the grocery store and somebody could talk to me, and next thing you know, you're stumble into something that's greater than all 100 of your ideas. So it's fun. I love it. It's a really stressful way to go about life and business,
right?
Especially not knowing what the hell you're going to do or if it's going to be any good when you get to the end of it. But once in a while, moments like that where you're just like sitting drinking whiskey at 11 in the morning in Wales with this little old man telling me about what it was like to hang out with Hitler and all these stories, I'm like, this is why I'm a documentary filmmaker, because shit like this.
It's unbelievable. So like if we go through the movie a little bit, like, so like I heard a little description in the movie. So the movie opens up with this, like you said, this little old man, this kind of frail old man in a doctor's office getting his hearing aids checked. And like immediately the scene, like you're first like, what the hell is this about? And immediately the scene just like pulls you in, because they're like, the question the doctor asked him was, you know, have you ever been around loud noises before? You know, and right away he's like, yeah, you know, I was a commando, you know, on this. And he almost like gives a summary sentence. He's like, yeah, we were trying to blow up a German ship and we're going towards the port in Saint-Nazaire, France, and a German occupied thing. And you're like, whoa, okay. Like, just that story alone is interesting. So it immediately like kind of draws you in into like that this guy's got something else going on. And like where the film goes after this is like absolutely like, I didn't see it coming at all. I thought it was going to be more just about, you know, his war experience, and it turns out it's about a whole lot of other things besides that.
Yeah, it's like, I think that's good and bad. It's like, it would have been easier if it was like an amazing war story film, but it's such, like you said, I mean, it's like there's so many aspects to his life that make it sort of, you're all over the place, from, you know, history to the king to war to Hitler to like bisexuality, being he's gay and it's illegal then, it's, and then love with his, when he finally got married to a woman. And so it's kind of like this film that never found, I mean, it never like did well in film festivals. It didn't even play in them because they're like, well, I don't know what this film is. Is it a gay film? Is it a war film? Like, yes, it's all those things. So it's like he was all over the place with all these sort of these facets of his life that each one of them could have been their own film. But yeah, so it actually made it harder to make the film. It's like, what do you concentrate on in a film like this? And how do you tell this little old man's story and get people to relate to him? So it was not like, I'm sure there was probably better ways to construct the film, but I just did my best to let him tell his own story and get everything in there, all the important stuff in there,
yeah,
sort of bullet points.
I think you really nailed it. Like, there's like that scene where he's like laying out all his photo, like he basically, they like from the film it says that he kept like absolutely everything, and like there's photos, there's poems, there's music, there's like a century's worth of like history all just sitting in like this one little room with this one historian. And like one of my questions was to you, like, how did you even go about trying to develop a plot, you know?
No, I mean, that was that's how you develop a plot is like, I was trying to figure out what visual I could use visually to help sort of make it simpler for a viewer. I'm like, maybe if Mickey, I mean, fortunately for the film, he had this like historian guy that's in the film, like writing his sort of putting everything down into these like archives for him. So that he's there. But then Mickey offered to like lay everything, his story out on this giant table, like from the day, you know, before he was born all the way to present day. And so that was sort of this device that I tried to use in the film to show how expansive his life was, but it's still like hard to wrap your head around all this shit that he went through and the stuff that he, I mean, the guy was like 100 years old and like there, you know, born. There's stuff I left out where he, in World War One, he was like dancing for, he was like, mom ran a cafe and he would come out and dance and sing to the soldiers in World War.
It's just, it's ridiculous.
Like, that's not even in the film.
Oh my God.
So he just like lived through like incredible stuff. And when I, in the film, he, we flew him. So he was in this raid in France and then captured and then taken to Germany. And we, in the film, we flew him back to France in this little plane. And I had to like get, send in our passport information for the, whatever, just for the plane, the guy that owned the plane. And I'm like, Mickey, I need your passport. So I found it. And I look, opened it up, and he was born in, it was like December 10th, 1912. And I go, I'm like, dude, you were born in 1912? And he goes, let me see your passport. And he goes, dude, you were born in 1973. Like, holy shit. Like, we're both sitting there laughing about how ridiculous it was that he's like, my wife, his wife died of old age in 1971. I'm like, Jesus Christ, man, we are very different individuals.
And he's very playful. I mean, like, I was telling Scott, like, some of my favorite scenes was just, like, some of the, like, smaller things where you see the joy in him. Like, just seeing him try to, like, send an email and opening off the coffee can and all. It's just so great to see. He's, like, laughing his ass off. He's like, I've been on, like, 300 journeys. I can't open up a coffee can right now.
Yeah, he, I mean, he like got shot by Nazis, but he couldn't figure out how to send to open a coffee can.
That was literally like, one of my favorite scenes of the movie because it just like showed you him, like it showed you him in like this real moment, like, you know, other than being interviewed, it just showed you like this laughter and this humble, like this humbleness to him. That was one of my favorite scenes because it like, I don't know, it took like the story out of it for just a second and showed you like maybe his everyday life a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, that's even more fun to me. Like, he's just like, he kind of, it's kind of interesting, like he kind of turned back into a big kid, you know. It's like he was, when he was this very sort of proper English, you know, like this high, like on the high crust of society for so long, and then he became this little old dude who was just sort of having fun at the end of his life and just loving to laugh and be silly and tell stories and stuff. And he literally acted like a kid. He's like crawling around in his blueberry garden, you know, like laughing and just like that.
Feeding the chickens. That was also a great.
Yeah,
show.
Man. He was just like, to me, he just
wearing
the
Obama shirt. That was, yeah. That was funny.
Yeah. He was having a blast and it made me really happy to, cause I've seen plenty of family members and people I know get old and just like, they're so unhappy in their old age. You know, it just makes me really depressed about getting old. But with Mickey, it made me feel the opposite. I'm like, dude, this guy is having a blast. He's so happy. He's, you know, he doesn't know how long he's going to be around, but he's having a blast. And that was inspiring to me. So that's why those moments are in the film. And there was other moments like that were hilarious, but that didn't happen on camera that I wish did happen on camera. But that's how documentary filmmaking goes. But he was like that all the time. So it could have been just been more fun as a film of those ridiculous moments, you know?
You know, like, you know, just other things, too, like, I found fascinating about the film. One was the relationship with his wife, which, you know, he's pursuing this girl, Mary, for, you know, for however long. He's pursuing. She ends up marrying him. She's this very attractive woman. And throughout the entire film, you know, he seems to never change his view on, like, her beauty or her, you know, what a great person she was. And then it, like, turns out underneath that he's either bisexual or gay, whatever you want to, you know, whatever tag you want to put on that. And that, like, it's just this amazing, like, shifted love story where he's absolutely in love with his wife, but yet he's not sexually attracted to her, but yet he's, I don't know, like the conundrum there was like fascinating to me. Like he never wavers on his view of Mary from what it seems anyway.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's like, it was really this amazing part of it was like, he just was so in love with this woman. And there's a lot more that didn't even make it in the film where he took me to where, to the church that she loved to show me like the stained glass window that she loved. And he showed me, you know, I met the pastor of the church. Like he was just so excited to talk about her. He talked about her more than he talked about anything. But at the same time, yeah, but at the same time, like he told me a story where like she'd be out of town and he'd have like men over to the house and then she would find the bed messed up and know that he had people over and but right. didn't care because she's like, oh, Mickey, just do what you have to do. Just make sure you clean up the bed next time. It's like, okay. Like, so it was like that. It was like a really complicated life that he lived because he went all the way back to being like gay when it was illegal. And he talked about how he turned himself into the cops
because
he didn't know what to do. And then ended up seeing like the king's doctor who's he said he, I can't remember if it was in the film or not, but he said the king's doctor, he said he pinched my nipples and fumbled my balls and said, son, you'll be all right. You just need to meet the right woman. And that was the end of
that was in the
that
film.
That might actually work out in the opposite direction if you think about it.
Right. Yeah, exactly. He's like, yeah. But I can't remember if it's in the film or not, but that's like what literally happened. It's like,
what's
so
in the
just
film?
So confused. He's like, I tried to turn myself in because I want to, you know. People didn't, you know, I don't know what to do. So
that part's in the film. I don't know if the balls and nipple pinch were in. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
You should add it back in.
Okay. I'll put it back in.
And if you don't have it, just recreate it with yourself and all. This is what Mickey went through.
Right. I'm going to play Mickey in the picture anyway. So.
But in all seriousness, I was very intrigued by that story just on like the tearing and the differentiating between love and sexuality and how he even got like a little graphic and talk about when he made love, he didn't even like ejaculate all the time. It was just the part of the passion of it, but he still maintained the love for his wife. And it's really interesting to see that kind of story. You don't see that a lot.
No, well, you don't find people that can talk that openly, man. That's like there's so much stuff that was said that I was like, all right, you didn't need to tell me that much information, dude. but it's like that's what he, you know, at that stage of his life, he was just having fun and just didn't care about, you know, he just like had no reason to hide anything anymore. So it was a really great to be able to talk to someone like that who was so open when normally you do a film about somebody, they're very, very careful about what they say, you know, they're just so they're thinking about everything. And meanwhile, Mickey's just like everything's coming out. He's talking about Audrey Hepburn's mother and he's like, she liked it like a man would. So I'm assuming that meant she said she took it from behind like a man. And he was telling me how he was interviewed for multiple Audrey Hepburn family documentaries and they never put him in them. They cut him out. I'm like, well, dude, it's because you're talking about your mom in a very graphic way. So, I mean, yeah, there's a lot of stuff said where it's like, it's amazing for him to be that into it and sort of like very open about stuff like that. That's very intimate and confusing and things that he's dealing with. You know, he's like, he was sleeping with men and women and very like powerful, famous men and women at the same time.
Yeah.
So it's like, imagine if he was like around now, like on Facebook and Twitter, he would just be like, have these people, you know,
he'd be a celebrity.
He would be a celebrity. Okay. Yeah. I mean, he was in his own right. He was hanging out with the right people where I think he was pretty well known in certain circles back then. Yep.
So, like, I compiled a list, and, like, there was a quote that the historian said, you know, he said, within the scope of Mickey's life, he virtually has a complete history of the 20th century, which is, you know, that's kind of a crazy quote, but I just compiled the little list, like, so he was a commando, he was a poet, he was shot, he was a prisoner, you know, he jumped off a boat, he met Adolf Hitler and hung with him, you know, he sent cigarettes to Audrey Hepburn's mother for penicillin, which ended up saving Audrey Hepburn's life. So, you know, history turned right there. Like, the world may have never seen Audrey Hepburn. You know, he lived across from Buckingham Palace. His father was knighted. He knew the king. He had an affair with a spy. You know, like, just that list alone sounds like I'm just, like, on peyote making this shit up, you know?
Imagine if someone came up to you and told you that in an airport. Would you believe them?
While hanging out with Lemmy.
Right. No, man, it's incredible. That's why it was sort of like a filmmaker's dream. I'm like, come on, man. This guy is like, it's incredible. It was just like an unbelievable amount of things that he saw that I like literally learned a lot of those things by watching Spielberg movies, you know, like or playing video games. It's like crazy that he was there and lived through these things. And it was just like this part of his life that he experienced. And it was sort of no big deal to him. He was like, yeah, of course, this is what I went through. And there's tons more little moments in his life. He like interviewed President Roosevelt and like traveled with the king and queen to Canada. There's just like so much stuff, dude. It's like and most of us are lucky if we can leave our cubicles.
Right.
So,
right. It's funny. I was saying to Berlow over here, I was saying it's amazing, like, not to get like existential, but right now we're talking four people away from someone like Adolf Hitler. Like, we're talking to you. You were in a room with Mickey. Mickey was in a room with Adolf Hitler. You know, like, you know, it seems when you're growing up and it's in history books and film, it seems so foreign. You know, now we're connecting three people away from that. It's just a wild thing to think about.
No, it is totally wild because I'm from Texas, so I remember like in high school I had Texas history. I think I learned about the Alamo, and then I'm pretty sure I learned about Hitler in Spielberg movies, and just like hearing him tell these stories about how he hung out with him in this cafe, and we took him to the cafe where they met.
Yep, and that was a powerful scene too.
I can't remember another thing that he told me, but I'm not sure it's in the film. But he spent so much time with one of the Mitford sisters, who was sort of a Hitler groupie, and they would hang out and see Hitler whenever they could, that Hitler had one of his sort of top SS guys sort of escort them and follow them around Germany and like be with them. So they're probably to keep an eye on them. And also because Mickey was like this British writer for the Times of London. So I think Hitler wanted to keep an eye on him, but also to make sure that this Mitford sister groupie was safe. And Mickey would get into these heated conversations with this guy who was like this really top, like undercover SS guy. And he said they had this heated argument in a cafe, and the waiter brought over this tray of tea, and Mickey flipped the tea tray over and knocked the hot tea and scalded the SS officer with the tea because of this like heated conversation they were having about British people being stupid. And Mickey scalded the guy with tea. I'm like, dude, you like burnt an SS, one of Hitler's right hand like SS officers. He's like, I'm like, but didn't you think something would happen? He's like, no, because I was with him with the like his girlfriend, so yeah, I knew nothing would ever happen to
me. Really,
it
is unbelievable. So like I was saying, it's like you know, regardless of like obviously Hitler's bad views, I'm going out on a limb there, but it just shows you like historically like what a compelling figure he, like Mickey later on said how embarrassed he was by it, how he didn't really see it you know, completely, you know, what a compelling figure he was, or influential, you know, figure that convinced people and stuff like that. You know, you never know, like, you know, how many other people in history were sucked into that and stuff like that just by his charisma and whatnot.
Well, no, I mean, I think there's a scene where he's with the Duchess of Devonshire, who's, yep. Well, she passed away recently, but she was a sort of figure.
Her sister, Bobo.
So she was like one of the Mitford sisters that are notorious for being supporters of Hitler before the war. And they explained it in a way that I never really knew before. They're like, we were supporting him because all we knew was that Germany had jobs and we didn't have jobs, huh. And our economy was shit and Germany's economy was not. And so we figured it was Hitler's doing. And so of course we're going to support him. And then as the, you know, there was no internet back then. Right, so there's nobody, right. Like it was cell phone. So it took a while for them to realize what was happening. And then they all felt just horrible. I mean, that's why Mickey was spending time with this guy, trying to figure out what was happening.
And then
once he figured out what was happening, he joined the commandos because he felt so awful, and then went and got him, you know, he went and fought them because of to make him, you know, to sort of rectify what he had done in his head by like complimenting Hitler and spending time with the guy. So it was really like interesting thing to hear and hear from that side of the story, where none of it, you know, all of the stuff we see is just like what you see in the films, and you don't see. I mean, the guy obviously was pure evil, but there was a way that it was covered up for a long time before the war started.
Persuasive, powerful force.
Yeah, you know? I'm sure he was charismatic. Otherwise, he wouldn't have gotten to that stage of power. It's crazy, but
it's an incredible story. So, can you tell us where does the movie stand right now? I know you've been trying to raise funds for quite a while. I've seen you've done an Indiegogo. I know you've been working with some of the guys in Practical Jokers. They've been trying to help out, raise money. What's the state of the movie right now with finances and getting it out there?
Well, it's fine. It's crazy because it's the film I thought would be like this hit on the indie film festival circuit because Lemmy did so well, and then it turned out nobody in the States cared about the film because it was sort of all over the place. Like we said, there's like so many different aspects of his life. But so it took a long time to get anybody to put it out, and it finally came out in the UK in May, but I put it out without having paid like for archival rights and stuff because I just didn't want to lose the opportunity to put it out. So it's out in the UK on iTunes and DVD, But I had a desperate need to pay those bills because I could get completely shut down by the big companies that own the archival rights in the film. So that's when I met Brian Quinn from the Jokers, and I showed him a bunch of projects that I was working on and just wanted to see if he'd help me with anything. And he watched the Mickey doc and he like freaked out. He's like, dude, this is the greatest story that I've never heard about. He's like, what can I do to help you? I'm like, well, I need to pay some bills. So he helped me do the Indiegogo campaign, and we raised enough money to pay for those bills, which now lets me to allows me to freely put it out. So it's coming out in the U.S. on, I think, on December 15th.
Okay.
Be out awesome. Here. Yeah, finally it'll be on DVD and iTunes and all that. Not like a major release, but it'll be out. And it's coming out in North America, and then I'll get it, figure out a way to get it out to the rest of the people, because like just Brian Quinn alone putting it out there into the world got, you know, your attention and a lot of other
yes.
people's attention that would never even ever heard of Mickey. I'm sure you guys, I would assume you'd, neither of you had ever heard of Mickey. And Brian Quinn told me he's a huge World War II,
yep.
you know, like he's very interested in all that stuff and never knew anything about the raid, let alone Mickey. So it's nice to finally get it out there so people can be sort of shocked by these yep. stories they never heard of. But yeah, so it's coming out in December here. That's finally. Awesome. And thanks in large part, if not entirely, to Brian Quinn.
Yeah. I mean, but I think, Greg, you just got to stay faithful to the film because, you know, it might be a slow grower. Like, because when you do watch the film, you go, oh my God, like, you know, that is a story that needs to be told. Like, you know, like, you're going through the, you know, the battles to get it out there. But I feel like once it's out there and with the, like, the support of social media and stuff like that, it could be a monstrous hit. It just might be a, you know, a late bloomer.
Yeah, I hope you're right, man. It's like one of those films where we all did it. I mean, we did it not – we knew we weren't going to get rich with a film like that, but we just do it because it has to be told. Mickey is such a great dude that his story deserves to be out there. So it's just like keep going and do what you can to put it out. So I'm psyched that it's coming out, and I don't – you know, I just want people to be able to watch it. So
yeah, that's awesome. Now, I did see you have done like one regular scripted film, Devoured. What's your take from that scripted versus documentary kind of style? Do you have a preference either way or what?
Yeah, I mean, I would prefer whoever will actually pay me to direct, so I'll do whatever I can get paid to do. But
right.
I've always wanted to make movies, and that's was my true passion from the beginning, and then the documentary thing happened accidentally. It's just a hell of a lot harder to make a proper feature film, narrative feature film, because it costs a lot more right. if you're going to do it a certain way. So that film was a good experience. But again, it's like I was pretty cocky after Lemmy because it did really well, but
right.
that doesn't translate into the psychological thriller world at all. Nobody gave a shit that I made a movie about a Lemmy. And then, you know, nobody in the documentary world gives a shit that I made a psychological thriller. So I kind of, you know, it's kind of like everybody's like, just focus on one thing. I'm like, I don't want to make fucking Lemmy documentaries my whole life.
Yeah, right.
But it's like true. Like I can get, you know, it's very not easy, but people will return my phone calls in the music world because I made Lemmy, you know. Right. So I'm now working on another really, really awesome music doc that I'm super psyched about because of Lemmy. And I made one on Johnny Winter, the blues guy, that's mm-hmm. coming out soon. Mm-hmm. So, but I love doing feature films. And one of the things Brian and I are going to try to do is turn Mickey's story into a film. So that's wow. going to be.
That would be
one of
awesome.
The things we're working on together. It's going to take a long time to get something like that made, but that's one of our goals.
That's awesome. So, like, I could talk to you for another hour about like Mickey and stuff like that and his POW experience, but I'll let the fans go and watch it and find the rest of it out. So, if people want to check you out or get information on the film and whatnot, where should they go?
Probably Mickey's Twitter is, I think it's Mickey Byrne movie. I can't remember the Twitter.
Mickey has a Twitter?
No, I have.
So I hashtagged Hitler and it was very awkward.
No, it's like, I think just my Twitter is usually the best place to go. It's Greg Oliver, just with two L's, GREGOLLIVER.
Right.
Or my company's called Secret Weapon Films. So that's where all these films are sort of coming through. But it's funny you just said that about Mickey and Twitter. I was explaining to him what Twitter was, and he was explaining to me what sending a telegram was. And it was literally yeah. like yep. Twitter. Like he could only put so many letters yep. in, otherwise it would cost too much, and it would be just really short sentences. It's
true.
He comes full circle.
Yep. Yeah, and then when he would send us, when he would send me an email, he would say, "Dear Greg, I hope all is well in New York." And then he would say, "Stop" with a period.
Oh my God, that's awesome!
Yeah, it was awesome. So that's how he would write his emails.
All right, Greg. I think we're gonna come to the end here. I want to thank you so much for coming on to the podcast, and we will surely do our job to try to promote the film a little bit. And it's really been a pleasure, and it's been great hunting you down.
Yeah, awesome film. Amazing.
We love
work,
the film, man. And thanks for coming on, man.
Yeah, thanks for your patience, man. Hopefully, it was worth the wait. I really appreciate you guys caring about the film, so, and for spreading the word. It's awesome, man. I really appreciate it.
Definitely will, man.
And good luck with your future projects and all that stuff. And
good luck with still dealing with Lemmy.
Yeah. Luckily, I don't have to deal with Lemmy anymore.
And
as much as I love the guy, I don't have to deal with him. I don't have to ask him if it's okay if I turn the camera on ever again.
But we really do appreciate you coming on, man, and I'm glad it finally happened, and I thought it was a great interview. So, you know, keep doing what you're doing, and we'll be supporting you here over at Verbal Shenanigans. So,
awesome, man. Looking forward to hearing the podcast. Let me know when it's out.
It should be probably tomorrow. So,
okay. No. Killer, dude. Well, no. Thanks for doing that, man. Really appreciate it.
Thanks
you
so
guys
much.
Have a glorious
ours,
night.
Man.
All right. Take care.
All right. Guys. Bye.
Yeah, as you can be saved for the site, and we're back.
Oh.
Yes. Informally back.
And mid-sentence.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Mm. But I am... what a great interview, man. What a great interview. Like, the thing that, like, sticks with me is that whole thing I brought up to him, that we're four people removed from Hitler, four people removed from this guy who was in a camp, a POW, all this stuff, four people removed from Audrey Hepburn. It's fucking 100 years later, you know, whatever it is later.
We're still six steps away from Kevin Bacon, though.
Yeah, and one step away from Sean Kemp. But absolutely, please go out and support that film, Turn Towards the Sun. I recommend it. The fact that it's getting released in December, I might just go and, you know, pay to go see it again.
Hell yeah.
Just to support. And
way entertaining. You
know, but super, 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 super cool guy, laid back. You know, just another great guest in it. I'm happy that I pursued him like a wolf. Like, I did not let him, because he canceled many times.
Mm-hmm.
But I just like, yeah, when's the next time? I think in his mind he was like, leave me alone. Leave me alone. I don't want to happen. But it turned out to be awesome. I'm very proud of that interview. So,
yeah, incredible stories. I mean, his whole entire work. I mean, who's he talked to and everything. It's just incredible, the stories that are out there still waiting to be told, you know?
Yes, that's where we're going to get.
Yeah. Well, the other thing I found interesting was in the movie is when they go through, like, all his pictures and that. We're never going to see that again. Like, he has all his old books with poetry, all his old photographs.
If anything, it's going to be, like, hard drives.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, all right, we got to go through Grandpa's whole history. Give me his hard drive.
Give me that one file.
Yeah.
I know, like, that layout of, like, all the photos, books, receipts, stuff like that. I don't even keep a receipt from anything. You give me a receipt, it's gone. It's, like, in my pocket and mashed with
my
keys.
Oh, yeah, I'm going to track it. And then it's like, why the hell do I have this in my pocket?
Oh, God. Patrice O'Neill had one of the best bits on receipts. He's like, as a black man, he's like, I go into stores and I ask for receipts for everything. And he's like, you know, I get a stick of gum, receipt, receipt. He's like, why? He's like, because when they pin a murder trial on me, they know where I am. I have a trail of, you know, where I've been that night. It's fucking brilliant. Missing that guy, too. But, yeah, so an amazing interview. And right before this, I guess we were talking about DraftKings real quick. So I am happy to have another sponsor on board. And hopefully we can make a little cashish off of it. Not a lot of cashish, but even if it covers just the expense of putting these damn things up. Mm-hmm. Maybe a new cord so we don't get any static.
Yeah.
But
you know, we want to, as we kind of talked about, as you press record, we're looking to build a site. Obviously, we'll be looking to do more comedy shows.
Yep.
So, I mean, anything that helps to entertain you people back.
And I do want to, since we're doing a little like promo thing, I do want to say I have gotten involved in the fashion world, Michael Berlew.
What?
The fashion world.
Do tell.
Because when you look at me, don't you see fashion?
Oh, yeah. Well, I described you earlier, and I mean, a lot of people will be shocked by how you look. Mm-hmm. I mean,
Because generally, when you wear like the same flannels for 11 years, they just come back into fashion.
Yeah, it's just timing.
I call it recycling.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting story. My dad puts me in touch with a guy he works with. This black guy, Richie. I don't know why I gotta say this black guy, but anyway, he wants to start a clothing company. Okay, and he wants to base it around beards. Okay, like beards is kind of like the theme of it and stuff
okay,
like that.
Okay.
And I've kind of partnered with him, and I'm helping him design some stuff. And I told him I would use the – really nice guy. Been through a lot of stuff that I'm going through. And I told him I could help him with my minimal Photoshop skills and then my little radio show and my comedy stuff. And we're going to call it Wolf Nation. Wolf Nation Ooh. Is the name of the clothing line that's going to come out. So,
is it like Wolf Cola?
Yeah, exactly like we call it. But it's Wolf Nation, W-U-L-F Nation. I didn't even ask him what it meant, but I've been helping him work on some designs and stuff like that. And hopefully I can help you out, Richie. And I don't know what I can do for you. I did a little design work. You're looking at the logo now, bro. It's got that nice urban hip-hop feel,
yeah.
which where you look at me, it's you definitely think urban and hip-hop.
Yeah.
But I think it's pretty cool. It's got a look to it, you know, so hopefully we can get something going.
It's got a little New York style with the brand. It's very street-like.
Yep, no, that was kind of the goal. And, yep. You know, that urban, maybe skater, maybe, you know how, like, skaters now are, like, kind of in the urban thing, too.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, this goes out to my boy Richie. I'm here to help you, brother, and we're going to get this going and just trying to expand into something else. Who knows? I just wanted to tell a quick story before we get out of here.
All right.
The other night I did that Meatballs and Brews
mm-hmm.
Friday down in Rahway.
Mario Lupino's very nice gig.
Yep. So I go down there and I'm doing the show, and we get there and there's a family there with like a 6-year-old girl,
mm-hmm.
and I'm like, really, you know, really, and it's getting closer to the showtime. I'm up second. Phil Hockman, the ageless wonder,
mm-hmm.
Phil Hockman's before me. In case you didn't know, he's like a 90-year-old comedian. He's funny. And
did he know Hitler?
He may know Mickey. So I'm getting closer, and my friends start showing up. I had a good turnout of friends. Shout out to my friends, but could like 8 people, like a lot of them who haven't seen me. So I'm in the predicament of like there's a 6-year-old girl, the audience 7 maybe, something like that. But my friends haven't seen me. I want to make an impression, you know, like at least be funny. So my name gets called, and as I'm going up there, I'm like, you know what? Fuck it. Like, I'm going to deliver my material. My material's not dirty, but no. It does have an edge to it, you know.
You're not PG-13, but it's not X-rated.
No. You know, but I have some stuff that makes people go, yeah. Oh, ooh, you know, like, which is fine. We are at a comedy club, you know. And my thought was, you know what? You're the parents who have your daughter here on a Friday night in a bar at 9:30. You're the parent, not me, okay? You can take them to whatever you want, but this is what's going to happen. And Phil had a couple off-color jokes, so he kind of set me up. And so the set just went amazing. It went amazing. And, you know, like, I don't really... Most of my sets, I'm like, yeah, it was okay, but it went really well. And I delivered...
I killed, baby!
Oh, it's the worst. I delivered one joke... And the little girl starts laughing so hard. And it threw me off, so, like, off in a good way. I just started laughing on stage. I said, oh, my God, I love this girl. I need her at every show. And I'm like, well, not love in the Jared Fogle way, but I love this girl. And everyone's like, oh. I'm like, what? Come on. Too soon?
And I grew up with Jared, man. That was low.
But it was great. But the best was I was delivering these jokes, and the mom had her hands over the daughter's ears as mm-hmm. I was describing, like, you know, some maybe R-rated material, but
mm-hmm.
oh, it was so fucking funny, man. Just like that decision to like go for it, it paid off because people did come up to me and said, good set, good set, good set. But like that awkwardness of who's in the crowd, like what do you think about that? Like, do you adjust your material or do you just go for it?
I guess it depends on the situation. I mean, I know like when we do... what's the pizza place? Starlight. Thank you. When we do Starlight, like a lot of times there's like a family over there, and I'm a little half and half on the basis of they came there for pizza. They don't necessarily come there for the open mic. So right. there's a little bit of me, it's like, well, if I chase away them, that's chasing away customers to the company. You know? When it's a advertised comedy show, it's full game.
I agree.
It's you are the one who chose it. You deal with the consequences. If you don't like the kid hearing curse words, should have been smarter today.
It reminds me of, remember when we were down in Union Joe's and Anthony Ennis was on?
Mm-hmm.
And he was delivering this ridiculous joke and this six-year-old girl walks in like right like as he's going. He's like, ah, you know, we were making fun of him the whole rest of the night. Like, he was making like a blowjob joke or something like that.
It kind of reminds me of a story. Like when I did Stand Up New York, I did like a bringer show and I was near the tail end. I was desperate to get people to go there. And like my sister was telling me she was going to come up there and go. And she ended up not showing up. I luckily got enough people so I could do the event. But I was talking to my cousin about it. I'm like, yeah, I'm a little disappointed my sister didn't come. And she's like, you know, I was talking to her and she was talking about bringing her kid up to New York for this stand-up club. And this is a stand-up club. This is not just, oh, we're having a bar show. That's an actual club, Stand-Up New York. And the kid was like 2 at the time. And I'm like, how do you think it's okay to bring a 2-year-old into a comedy club?
This doesn't make sense. Like, people, just, you go in a comedy club, you know you're going to hear some edgy stuff here and there, and even just, even if it's not edgy, it's still not appropriate for kids.
Yeah, and especially don't get mad if a comedian says an offbeat joke. It's like, you knew what was coming in here. I'm doing my job up here. Live with it.
Yeah. So I think that's going to bring us to the end here, Berlu. Just a quick note, another tragic day in America today.
What's up?
Did you see the shooting today?
Oh, I heard about it. I didn't see it. Yeah.
Horrendous. A reporter, a cameraman, and the person they were interviewing, a fucking disgruntled employee comes up, films himself shooting the people with like his GoPro or his phone, like a first-person shooter, shoots them on air. On air.
Wow, I didn't.
Just an absolute disgusting dirtbag, and it's just, it's so sad, man. It's so absolutely sad. So my thoughts and condolences go out to the families of those people.
And he was, he didn't even like man up to take the punishment. He took care of his own life. And
yeah, he shot himself and later died. But it's just like, he's like, oh yeah, they said there was human resources complaints about the woman on air. Like, what happened to manning up and settling differences? Instead, you're going to go shoot somebody and film it? The footage is just, it's so creepy.
Yeah, that's something I really wanted. I mean, even if it was out, I'm sure it's out there. I don't want to see it.
Yeah, it's sad, man. It really is sad. So thoughts and condolences go out. Berlu, on a lighter note, what do you got?
Again, as we brought up earlier about the tragic passing of Justin Wilson, the IndyCar Federation, they have started a charity in honor of him. If you'd like to donate in honor of Justin, you can send any donations to the Wilson's Children Fund, care of IndyCar, 4551 West 16th Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46222. If you need that email address, that address again, you can just go on the Verbal Shenanigans Facebook page.
Or email us at verbalshenaniganspodcast@gmail.com. And, it's sad, you know, like doing those events, it does make you feel like part of that community a little bit, or at least seeing behind the scenes and how much people care and how much work goes into that.
It's a family thing, all racing, all sports, and just a damn tragedy, and prayers to the family, and God bless you, sir. Hope you're doing well.
And I want to, first and foremost, I'd like to thank Greg Oliver for coming on. One hell of an interview.
Great
Very
stories,
happy to have
great
him on.
Guest.
Also, I want to thank DraftKings for letting us promote their product, and that's always nice. And I want to thank Obi
for
International Dog Day.
Thank you, Daddy.
He got his sparks in today, and I want to thank him for being my best friend.
Thank you, Daddy.
I just want to thank that little puppy for keeping me going.
I love you too.
I'm petting him as we speak.
And ooh, that's me.
Serious note, but other than that, some things to look at.
Me.
Next podcast we should have, if not the next, or the next one, we should have Tooth Grinder coming on, which is a band under my brother's record label. Not my brother's label himself, but one he works for. A band just about to go on world tour. So I'm excited for that. Look out for some future guests. And go check out Turn Towards the Sun. Excellent film coming out in December. So tweet us. Let us know what you think. Follow us at VS Comedy. Life is punny. Life is punny.
Is it? Are we going back to the Lumber Cast?
Life is funny, people. Laugh at it. Keep the wind at your back. Thank you for your support.
Here comes the Ope.